Tonight on Mouthful, we visit the Hilo Farmers Market, the Hawaiian Vanilla Company, and a mangosteen farmer on part two of Mouthful's Big Island Adventure. Stay tuned.
You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys something. You see, you start out with a little bit of water, and you fry some garlic. You throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You got to do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. A little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet. My country, 'tis of thee. I eat for social progress. I eat for victory.
Hey, hey, delicious.
The Hilo Farmers Market is like no other. There are women making leis wedged between farmers offering sweet onions, garlic, and delicious butter avocados. Green, pink, and red anthuriums, some as small as matchbooks, others as big as dinner plates, sell for about $5 for a huge bouquet. On the mainland, we pay about $3 a stem. There's delicious prepared food for sale, island goat cheese, fresh fish, and fruits and vegetables you might not recognize. Across the street from the main market, there are aisles of vendors selling everything from beach towels and aloha shirts to antiques and Kahlua pig. If you visit the Big Island, you must take time to see this market. During my visit this spring, I spoke with three vendors, one selling honey from hives near Kalapana, another who makes goat cheese, and a woman who has been growing vanilla in a lava crack for nearly three decades.
So yesterday we went to Kalapana, where the road ends, and Verna's is there. We had an Ono burger, and there were these great little shops, and one of them had beehives in a glass. And now we're here at the Hilo Farmers Market, and it's got her tricks glass bee display, right?
It is, yes.
So it's a little island.
Yes, very small.
So you are a beekeeper here on the island?
Yeah, I've been here about 6 years. Learning bees. I worked in Marin County for 10 years, working with a guy at Marshall's Farm Honey.
Oh, I know Marshall's Farm Honey. So you were beekeeping on the mainland before you came here?
Yeah, I was.
What's different about keeping bees in Hawaii?
Well, with the tropical weather, we have great nectars flowing year-round. So it's constantly honey all the time. Compared to the mainland, a lot of times you have to move the hives during the winter, the cold seasons. But here we've got such a variety of flowers, and it changes every month. I harvest my honey monthly, so every month the texture and the color and the taste changes of the honey.
And that's based on where the bees are feeding?
Correct, yeah, and what type of flowers is in bloom at that time.
And what are the different flowers? Because, you know, in Sonoma County, or in the Northern California, you have clover, eucalyptus, you're getting lavender now. I imagine it's all really different here.
Yeah, out here, the major nectars, which are the flowers, are lehua, macadamia nut, and a plant called Christmas berry, which is a Brazilian pepper plant. It kind of brings a spiciness to the honey. That's wintertime.
Now, lehua is the plant that blooms first out of a lava flow. So could you describe what the taste and texture of honey from the lehua is?
The tree itself is called the ohia tree. It's a real hardwood, which you're correct. It's the first tree that comes out of the lava. And it's the honey's probably the sweetest honey on the island. It's a real light honey it produces. And it tends to crystallize pretty quick compared to the mac nut or the Christmas berry. Won't crystallize at all. But it's probably the sweetest honey, light texture that we have here on the island.
And are there a lot of natural, I guess you'd call them feral colonies in Hawaii?
Yeah, it's kind of nice here on the island being isolated. There's no diseases like there are in the mainland. So wild hives exist all over.
And do you collect wild honey, or do you do it all from hives that you operate?
Mostly all the hives that I operate. I collect some occasionally from the wildness, but it's not too fun. They're mostly a little aggressive, the wild hives.
And then you sell only at farmers markets, or do you distribute also?
I distribute to maybe 3 or 4 local grocery stores, but most of the markets, they're here at the farmers market here in Hilo and one right outside of Pohoa Town.
And what's the brand name that you use?
Meli'o Kaimu, which is honey of Kaimu, and Kaimu is the area where I'm from.
And what do you do with the beeswax?
I make beeswax candles with it.
Do you earn a living doing this, or do you have to have another job as well?
No, this is it. I'm kind of living the farmer Hawaiian-style life. Simple. I don't get rich, but I get by.
Uh-huh. That's great. Thank you so much. Another vendor at the Hilo Farmers Market is Orchid Isle Vanilla, and I'm talking with Helen Lamberth. And first, there's just this beautiful display of vanilla beans in hand-blown glass. Before we talk about your vanilla, Helen, tell me about the hand-blown glass.
Oh, we were looking for some interesting ways to display the glass, and we found it through a friend. Just pretty hand-blown glass. I don't know what else to say about it.
That's fine. It's really a gorgeous way to show off the vanilla. How long have you been farming vanilla?
I've been farming for 25 years.
Whereabouts?
In Hilo, in a small little area called Kyokaha, where I've lived for 20-some-odd years, yeah.
And how many, I don't know how you count by the numbers of plants or acres. How much do you have?
My farm is in a lava crack. it's in a lava crack, literally. It's a collapsed lava tube, and it's a very small area, but it's grown underneath the canopy of the Hawaiian jungle. I've opted to keep it organic as it was originally. Some 15, 20 years ago, I moved to Kyokaha, and I noticed vanilla in my backyard. And while I was raising children, needed some time out, learned how to pollinate, and just kept it going. And I'd given them away for many, many years because Hawaii's market just wasn't ready to accept vanilla. I think most Hawaiians didn't know what to do with vanilla. It's not like poi. You know, you can stick your finger in it and eat it right then and there. So it wasn't until just fairly recently when the Hawaiian sugar thing went down and we needed another product. And I think Hawaii was looking desperately to diversify in agriculture. And so they looked at vanilla as an option. We have some small farms. I've tried to start some small farms myself in hopes that I could form a cooperative. But it's been slow. We'll see what happens. We still have to compete on the world market with places like Tahiti and certainly countries like Madagascar and Mexico and India. And we'll see how Hawaii does.
About how much vanilla do you produce a year?
You know, I'm a very, very small farm. I think in my last crop, I maybe had 1,000 beans. So I'm very, very small. I've opted to keep it small because you know, Hawaii state government really doesn't really have enough support for agriculture. And certainly it really isn't much in the way of money to support small farmers per se. So you really have to, you're basically on your own. Yeah, yeah.
And tell me a little bit now about your beans. You have some that are in shrink wrap that feel, when I press on them, they're softer than the dried beans. What's the difference between the two?
Well, this particular package that you're looking at was given to me by a little old Japanese lady, so sweet. She had no idea how to package vanilla and thought that this was the way to do it. It isn't. You really need to dry beans down to about a 30% moisture content, just soft enough so it can wrap around your finger. It's got to have pliability to it. Otherwise, if you're putting it in a container, you need to have it in an airtight glass container, preferably. That would be my thoughts on that.
How did you learn what you needed to learn? Because I know you have to hand pollinate, and I assume that the hand pollination has to take place during a fairly narrow window of time.
It does. The process takes place. In terms of the pollination, you have just a few hours, say 8 o'clock in the morning till noon in Hawaii, is when the flower is most susceptible to pollination. And it's a delicate little process. I use a toothpick to expose a tiny little hole just below the I don't know what we call this, just below the pollen cap. And it's fairly quick. Takes me about 3 seconds to complete the whole process. Other than that, I don't know. What else?
And then after you've dried the beans, do you sell them all at the farmer's market?
I do. The farmer's market is the only place that I sell my beans. It's a very small, cozy little hometown place, and it's neat. Yeah, I love it. Oh, and I've also sold my vines over the years. It was my hope to start women, to get women interested in growing vanilla in Hawaii. There's a huge domestic violence, single women, you know, who have really, really struggled in Hawaii. And I thought, you know, I could somehow help them to start little farms, just like they do. You know, we have little farms. Why not? And it would be a little extra income for them and their families. And I teach them how to pollinate. Women are much better pollinators, by the way.
And how many, once a vine is mature, how many pods will you get off one vine a year?
It takes about 3 years from a 16-inch cutting to actually produce an orchid. And then it takes an additional 8 months. Once the flower has developed into a bean, it takes another 8 months. And then from there, there's a blanching process, an additional, 3 to 4 weeks to do the initial processing for curing. And I generally store my beans for up to another 6 months. So from the time that I start, from the pollination period all the way to the marketable period, it takes me about a year and a half to get it to this point. Yeah. And thus, we have quite an elaborate little bean that's very expensive, actually, uh-huh, in Hawaii, because we just don't have the large amounts of vanilla to sell them by the kilo or by the ounce.
Do you like to cook with vanilla? Do you use your own beans?
You know, I used to bake many years ago. I'd much rather make extracts, but federal law stipulates that in order for me to make extracts, because it has an alcohol content, that I need to have a federal license to do so. Yes.
Really?
Alcohol, firearms, and tobacco, I believe.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know you needed that for extract. That's
you
really
do,
interesting.
You do in the state of Hawaii.
Mm,
oh, you're smelling a vanilla extract that's made actually using vodka. But I prefer rum. I prefer a nice, cheap rum. Maybe a Hana rum, or what else did we find? 151 proof is generally what we use.
You don't have the sort of farm that people can come visit by any chance, do you?
You know, I don't at this point, because it's not only such liability, it literally is a lava crack. I'm serious about that.
And is that where you live, too?
I don't. I'm actually between Hawaii and Washington State. I live part of the year here in Hawaii. I've lived here most of my life. I'm originally from the Fiji Islands. I came here many, many years ago. Went to school in Australia, learned how to speak the Queen's English.
Yeah, you have that hint of an accent.
Australian. Yeah, and then I came to Hawaii and just been here ever since. So part of my life is spent here. It's very expensive to live in Hawaii. So you've got to try to make a living elsewhere, and that's basically what I do. I'm a seamstress and a farmer.
Well, thank you so much for your time. Your beans are really wonderful. I didn't expect to find goat cheese in Hawaii, and I don't know why I didn't. I guess just because it's so ubiquitous in Sonoma County. This is Lava Rocks Puna Goat Cheese, and I'm talking with Lava Stacy, and you're one of the two partners in the farm?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I am.
And tell me, let's start out, how many goats do you have?
We have 30 goats, and we're milking about 10 at a time now.
And you
sell a very small farm.
And you sell your cheese at the farmer's market anywhere else?
Yeah, KTAs around the island and all the health food stores.
So why don't you tell me a little bit about the style of goat cheese that you make?
Well, we make various artisan cheeses. A lot of times goat farms get stuck just making Chev, and they just mass produce Chev. And we want to educate the people in this community, because Polynesian people ate goats, but they never ate goat cheese. And it's a very healthy lifestyle for them. They eat a lot of really high-fat foods here. and goat cheese is so healthy for them. So we're trying to do artisan cheeses from all different places in the world, so people get a taste of what you can do with it.
Give me some examples of some of the ones that you make.
We make ricotta. We make whole milk ricotta and whey ricotta. We make queso fresco, three different flavors, natural, cumin chili, dill garlic. We make feta. And then we make chèvre, of course. And we age chèvre in olive oil because it's very hard to age cheeses in Hawaii because we have such high humidity. So we age it in the olive oil that protects it. And we're thinking of dipping the chèvre balls in honey. No, beeswax. So it would be, it would have like a little Hawaiian bee flavor in there.
Oh, that's interesting. So you would seal it.
Yeah, seal it so it could keep aging.
Oh, that's a really interesting idea. Where did you learn to make cheese? Were you making cheese before you came to Hawaii?
Well, I've lived in Hawaii for 21 years, and I started working at a goat farm that was already here, and I learned to make cheese from them. Then they closed down, and I just had the opportunity to buy the farm and start doing it there. So I've been doing it for 7 years now.
Uh-huh. And could you describe geographically what it's like, where the farm is?
We live up towards Volcano. And it's open land, pasture land with lots of rolling rocks. So we grow a lot of food for the goats around the fence lines, things that are native to Hawaii that keep regrowing so we can cut them down and throw them in for the goats. It's really open. The goats live in this lovely old airplane hangar, so they have this huge indoor space where they run around. They have big rocks to climb around in.
What breed of goat?
Well, since we're so far from the mainland and we're such a small farm, we have a mixture, mostly alpine, but we have Toggenburg, Nubian, and Saanen, and we're not trying to do any purebred show kind of goat style here. We're just doing the ones that are big and strong and make lots of milk.
And about how much do you produce a year?
Oh, I think last year we sold 3,000 pounds of cheese. Yeah.
Wow. So
yeah.
You're, you know, little but still
we're
substantial.
Little, but we're doing good.
That's
yeah.
really
In
great.
In 4 years, we'll be where we want to be.
Uh-huh. And where is that?
Eating better. Paying our bills.
And you, do you have plans to distribute it off of Big Island to the rest of Hawaii?
We could do that. We'd like to get a few hotels. The business that I bought from, they used to supply, you know, to all the big hotels, Roy Yamaguchi and I can't think of the other chef's name, but you know, they were selling 500 pounds of cheese a week. We're selling 120 pounds. So we need to be selling about 300 pounds a week to be making it. So we're open to going wherever we need to do that.
Well, good luck to you, and
right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
O Kalapana, kaere o nui, uarono ka uka ore, e wala kalapana. Hey.
You're listening to Mouthful on KRCB. It's our Big Island Adventure, Part 2. As you head up the Hamakua Coast on the northeastern side of Big Island, you'll find the Hawaiian Vanilla Company off the main highway, but not really too hard to find. The company sells most of its beans to the island's chefs and caters to visitors and tourists who come for lunch and daily lectures and slideshows about the vanilla grown here. There's a gift shop, too, where you can buy all manner of vanilla products, from beans and extract to lotion, tea, candles, and more.
Hi, my name is Jim Reddykop. I'm the owner and founder of the Hawaiian Vanilla Company, located in the small village of Pauwilo on the Hamakua Coast on the slopes of Mauna Kea Volcano.
And how long have you been here, Jim?
We've been here for 6 years. We moved over from the island of Oahu. We were living, I'm born and raised on the island of Oahu. And we've been at this location for 6 years now.
And you produce vanilla from the orchids, so you do it from the very beginning to the end process, right?
Yeah, we're very vertically integrated in the companies that we grow the raw material, process it, and then turn it into value-added products, all in one place.
How much vanilla do you produce a year?
We're currently producing 200 pounds of vanilla, and about 100 pounds of that is gourmet grade A. Another 100 pounds is basically for our value-added products, our extracts, beauty care products, teas, coffees, all the flavorings that go into those products. We're in expansion mode right now. We're going from a 30,000-square-foot facility to over 180,000 square feet, about 4 acres of production. And it's all in cooperation with the USDA and a small business innovation research grant that we recently received called Vanilla, an Economic Engine in a Rural Community. There are actually two types of vanilla that are cultivated throughout the world. There's over 120 different vanilla orchids that grow wild, but only two that are commercially produced that actually create a fruit. It's a fruiting orchid. One in Tahiti, the Tahitense, and the planifolia is grown throughout the world, but only in Tahiti do they grow the Tahitense. The one grown in Tahiti would be when it's marketed as Tahitian vanilla or French vanilla. It's very floral in its bouquet. It has much different notes than does planifolia. Planifolia is more earthy, more balsamic, and much more widely used than the Tahitian. It really comes down to a matter of opinion when I've talked to chefs and, you know, which one do you like, planifolia over the Tahitian? And it depends on the chef and really what he makes. If he's into sweets and making pastries and that sort of thing, he'll really stick to the Tahitian. If he wants to be creative and go into the savories, which seems to be the pattern where a lot of these great chefs are going now, and the savory dishes using vanilla, then planifolia makes that path really well. Mexican vanilla, Indonesian vanilla, vanilla grown in over 50 different countries would be planifolia. It's very similar to the vanilla we grow here is planifolia. One thing, it's like coffee. And that an Arabica bean is grown throughout the world, but in Kona, we call it Kona coffee. With vanilla beans, we are taking a vanilla planifolia, growing it Hawaiian heat, sweet rains, mild breezes. We're growing it on U.S. soil, makes it more appealing for the consumer to know where it's being grown, to know who's growing it, to know what they're putting on their crops. Other countries that grow an assortment of other crops, we really don't know what they're putting on their plants. But there are characteristics by region for vanillas that are grown throughout the world. There's actually a flavor map or a flavor profile, almost a fingerprint, you might say, of vanillas that come from different regions. Ours has a fingerprint of it. Ours is very balsamic-y, a lot of earth tones to it. The one grown in Madagascar is very similar to what we grow here in Hawaii. And the current plant stock that we are getting in now has come from by way of Madagascar. When you get into growing plants, it's like breeding horses. You want to know who the mother of the mother of the mother is. And it hasn't been until recently that we've started to do that. It's been about a year that we've wanted to learn where we can get our hands on the best plants that will produce the best in the field. Very similar to grapes and wine, where the vineyard is buying their stock from. Sometimes those are passed on from generation to generation. And that plant material is sacred. And that's really what we're doing right now, is establishing plant stock here in the U.S. that my children will be able to carry on and have a healthy industry. The first plant material that we used was a planifolia. It was found wild. And we went ahead and tissue cultured or miracloned those plants. And what we found under commercial production is that those plants, they didn't live up to what we wanted. They didn't give us what we were asking of them commercially. The new plant variety we have is a proven plant, plant stock, and it's disease tolerant and a very high vanillin content in it, which chefs like to have a high vanillin. That's a very nice flavor profile, is having a good vanillin content, and so we're really excited about the new plant material we're getting.
Could you tell us a little bit about your mentor?
I was a giddy little school kid, I guess, when I got started with it, and I kind of looked this as I didn't find a love of learning till I was about 37 years old, and I was a troublemaker in school, and I didn't listen to my teachers very well, but our kids are homeschooled, and thank God I married a really smart woman to do this, but for my kids, to teach them the love of learning, I know what it is now, and I found it through vanilla. And at a dinner conversation 10 years ago, somebody said, what are you going to grow on your farm? We had the two children at the time. We wanted to raise them in a rural environment. We wanted to start a farm, and we didn't know what we were going to grow. We just knew we wanted to raise our kids that way. Vanilla happened to be the crop that came up. I started researching and almost being like an investigative reporter, wanting to find out, you know, who is growing this? How are they growing it? How do they do it? And I found in the spice world, everything's a secret. It's always been a secret. And it's kept that way for a very good reason, you know, from the beginning of time, it's always been kept secret. But I did find one man. His name's Mr. Tom Karaoka. And it was my first time meeting and beginning to have a relationship with a farmer. I've always been in the tourism industry and sat behind a desk and did a lot of paperwork. And this man had spent his life around plants, and it was very, very different. I was intrigued. I wanted to know all that I could. And for him at first, he wanted nothing to do with me. I was this eager little boy who wanted to learn about growing vanilla, something he had spent 20 years doing. I just came off the street and said, teach me all you know. And at first, he wouldn't teach me anything. Japanese culture is very interesting, that when you come to learn Japanese cultures, you start from the very bottom. And you start before kindergarten. If you looked at the school structure, he started me basically at the very, very bottom. And I wanted to learn all I could. And he saw how determined I was. So over 6 years, we began a relationship. I'd go just spend the mornings with him. And eventually his wife would make me breakfast. At first they wouldn't make me anything. They just wanted to see if I'd show up. And they'd make me breakfast and we'd start to talk. And he had the story to tell and I wanted to listen. And for 6 years I did that. And I went from elementary school to intermediate. And then I graduated from the Tom Karaoka College of Orchids. You know, it was an awesome ride. And Tom died last October. I was fortunate enough to go to his funeral. And it was on Oahu. He had two. And there was about 800 people there. And I thought, I didn't know this guy had that many friends, you know. I was sitting there thinking, what did I remember about this guy? You know, he was funny. He was really funny. You know, he thought things, he looked at things totally different. He wasn't college trained. He never went to college. He learned everything by using his hands and trial and error. And that's what I dug. I'm looking at this guy going, just try it. You're going to fail. You're going to fail. You're going to fail. You're going to succeed. If you succeed once, then that gets you to the next level. You're going to fail, you're going to fail, you're going to fail, and boom, you get to the next level. So he really taught me that kind of basic research approach. When he died, though, I really felt I wanted to give something back. And he never asked for money. He never would take money from me when I offered it to him. And so we developed the Tom Karaoka Scholarship Fund. This is the first year we're going to fund it. It's $3,000 to a graduating high school student on the Hamakua Coast who has an interest in going in agriculture. When we're looking at young kids coming out of high school, and I've done school groups here, and, you know, how many of you want to be a farmer? You will not see a hand go up. They want to be a policeman. They want to be a doctor. They want to be a lawyer. But if we're not educating and really teaching these young kids about growing the food we eat, we're in big trouble, really big trouble. So this scholarship fund was established to send a high school graduating student out into agriculture in hopes that they'll come back to the coast and apply that to the industry that's here. So that's that.
What's your favorite way to enjoy vanilla?
I'll take it in food. I create a roasted fennel with a Hawaiian vanilla citrus marinade that I do. I bake few things, and I do a lemonade here.
Tell me more about the fennel.
The fennel is a recipe that my wife presented to me and said, try this for a party we were doing. And the pork is marinated in citrus and vanilla and fennel. Citrus and vanilla is incredible. What vanilla does with the citrus, be it lemons or limes or oranges, is takes any acidity out of the flavor, which when we do our lemonade, it's incredible because we're taking real raw natural beans. We're slicing them down the center. We're scraping the seeds into the mix, and you can really taste. That's how people, when they come to our restaurant here, they taste that smoothness of what the vanilla does to citrus. The roasted pork and fennel, we go ahead and marinate that for two nights. I'll go ahead and saute up some red peppers and yellow peppers and onions. We use the Vidalia onions, and then serve that on a rye bread. With some really good mayonnaise, and it's all got calories in it, and it's wonderful.
So you serve lunch here 2 days a week, is that right?
We're currently doing it 2 days a week. We're going to go to 3 days next month. It's a four-course meal that's both features sweet and savory dishes with the Hawaiian vanilla, and of course it has our signature Hawaiian vanilla bean ice cream at the end. But it's been interesting how that all evolved. I mean, we started as a farm, and my wife's marketing background and my marketing background, we started to see we could create a destination to bring people out and really have them connect with the land in which it's been grown in. I mean, you go to restaurants in Hawaii, there's fantastic cuisine, and it says, Herbar Farms, or it says, Hawaiian Goat Dairies, or it says Hawaiian Vanilla, but you're sitting at this real fancy restaurant, and waiters are all busy walking around, and I'm displaced by it in a sense that, when you're eating here, I mean, the lettuce was grown right there, and the vanilla was grown over there, and then you're sitting down having this meal. It's a combination of food and farms and flavors, and people are just going, this is awesome. And it's really evolving into a cool event. We do the tastings in the mornings, which you just were able to do, and we do an afternoon tea at 3, and the future is the next step is going to dinner seatings at 7. Everybody kind of looks at the French Laundry and what Chef does there, and does a remarkable job where the meal is an adventure. It's an experience because you don't know what's going to be served. It's what's been bought that day or brought into the kitchen that day. It's a one seating, and it's just this exploration and to sit down and wow me. And, we're excited. I hope to do that by the fall, that we can start offering that and getting into those things. My job, and when we do our strategic planning, all that I've ever wanted to do is be on my tractor and be in the greenhouse around plants. My wife and her crew that do all the cooking are really a part of. I get to come up and taste all the mistakes. I walk in the kitchen and I go, any mistakes? Because I'm eating it. I'll eat it.
Okay, well, great. Good luck to you with all these new additions, and thanks very much. It's fun to have you on Mouthful.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. Aloha. Yeah.
Malini. Aina uve ikanoe ahi ahi uala venai ikamakani o olua.
Listening to Mouthful on KRCB Public Radio for Sonoma County. Kendall Murphy lives north of Hilo in one of the most spectacular estates I have ever seen. It is a rare gem hidden pretty much in plain sight in an average nice neighborhood. Driving by, you would never expect the rows of mangosteen trees and the unusual varieties of palm trees tucked behind an ornate gate. When we first arrived for our interview, Kendall opened a bottle of champagne and began to tell a story of how a retired vice president of Pac Bell living in Marin County became a mangosteen farmer in Hawaii.
Will you describe, first of all, where we are geographically?
We're in Papaiko, Hawaii, a little town just north of Hilo, about 8 miles.
How many acres here?
10.
And I've come here because of rumors of mangosteen. Will you tell us about that part?
Mangosteens. Well, the rumors are true. We do have 30 mangosteen trees here. It was an experiment by the guy that built this place in that a mangosteen is primarily a Southeast Asian tree. And it's maybe the healthiest fruit on the planet. It's heavily researched. If you just go into Google and type in mangosteen, mango, S-T-E-E-N, and skip all the hype, a lot of which is true, but go right to the research papers, and you'll find it's maybe one of the more studied fruits on the planet as well.
And what is the hype about mangosteens? I'm not aware of it.
It has they have a property called xanthones in them, X-A-N-T-H-O-N-E, and it's like a super antioxidant. I mean, I'm no expert in this, actually, but this is what I know from my own research on it, a super antioxidant. So it's been heavily studied for everything from reducing blood pressure to potential cancer treatments and a lot of other things. If you just go on the web, you can find out all of this stuff by looking at the research papers. I think you could get about, in one paragraph research summaries, you could probably get at least 20 pages of that in no time.
Amazing. And on top of it, it's maybe the best tasting fruit in the world.
It is. It's my favorite fruit is actually lychee, and there's plenty of those on this island, some very near here. But I think the second favorite for me is mangosteen.
Do you know how old the trees are?
The trees here must be about 15 years, give or take, although they're planted in two sets. They first planted a row of trees here, and then a few years later, they decided to put additional trees in between. So there are 30 on this property. This property used to be a 50-some acre property. So there are 30 on our piece of that, which is 10 acres, and who knows how many are on the rest of them there. There's another, you can see later, there's another stretch of them here, less than 30. But then on the property down below us here, there are also mangosteens spread all over the place down there.
And what happens to the mangosteens? Are they sold at farmers markets, that sort of thing?
It's easy to sell them at farmers markets. They're a very prized fruit. So it's no trouble at all to sell them at farmers markets. The health food stores will also buy as many as you can produce.
And what time? When do they come into season?
That's an interesting question. I don't know when that would be in places like Southeast Asia because the climate's different and the fruiting is heavily dependent on the climate. The trees actually need to be stressed in order to produce reliably fruit. And the climate here is mostly wet, which means they're often not stressed at all, and so they may not produce fruit for some time. When there's a drought here, and a drought in this area, we're in the middle of the rainforest, one of the rainforest areas on this island, and a drought here is 3 weeks long. If it doesn't rain for 3 weeks, it's considered a drought. We don't even have an irrigation system on this property of 10 acres, and there are a lot of palms, a lot of expensive plants on this property. I'm told by the International Palm Society, it may be the best palm collection on the islands here. But we don't have any irrigation system whatsoever because it's not needed. It rains a lot here.
So when you do have a little mini drought like that, it causes the tree to fruit.
Yeah, it causes the trees to undergo some tension, which causes some chemical change in the tree that, among other things, encourages fruiting. I think it's also true of lychees here. There are different ways of stressing the lychee trees. And it's almost, it's analogous to a human. When you get into different moods or you think you're in danger, neurochemicals get transmitted from your glands into your body. Well, believe it or not, trees are like that as well. I mean, we think they're just simple things. They're standing there doing whatever is supposed to happen, but they actually have personalities in that sense. And so the stressing of the tree in various ways can, among other things, trigger fruiting. And it's rained here for quite a bit. It's been an unusually wet season this year. So, unfortunately, you might have seen some fruit here, but because it's been wet so long, it hasn't stressed the trees, and therefore the fruiting hasn't started yet.
And when it does start, you have that dry period, and the fruit forms. How long from the beginning formation of the fruit until you have something edible?
I don't really know. I haven't studied that, but I would say at least a couple months or so, 2 or 3 months at least.
So it's really the drought will cause the fruit to happen and then it begins to grow.
Yeah, and that's, I'm talking again about this particular island. It's not a natural tree here, and it may be in other places the seasons are different and they may be more seasonal and more dependable for that reason. But here in this kind of wet climate, it's different. It's totally dependent on the climate here.
Now, it's a pretty spectacular and special piece of property. Even though I've been here about 5 minutes, you can tell that it is. How did you come across it?
Actually, it was a mistake. We never intended to move to Hawaii. We came over here on a sabbatical. I was having a lot of health problems in California.
Oh, so you were in California? Where in California?
In Marin County in Novato. And I was having lots of respiratory problems, and Kaiser couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. We came over here on a sabbatical because we were at that point in our lives when we thought, well, our lives are going well, but let's not get into an unconscious path. Let's just take 6 months off and think about what do we want to do with the rest of our lives. We came over here, and after 3 years of being tested by Western doctors who couldn't figure out what was wrong with me, in 24 hours, most of my symptoms were gone. It turned out I'm just hypersensitive to air pollution. And when I got out of the air pollution, my symptoms went away. So I've been as healthy here as I've been for the last several decades. So we just decided not to go home. and we bought a house. Initially, we were thinking we just have a house in the winter when my problems were worse in California. And then we'd spend winters here and the rest of the year, half the year in California. But we were looking around, and we found several houses that met all our specs. We checked off this list, had a list of specs. And something was wrong, so we never made an offer. We couldn't figure out why. It turned out what was missing but wasn't conscious to us was there was no inspiration in these other homes. Serta went on the web and started looking for places and accidentally put an extra zero in. And this house came up, and she said, "I want to go see this house." And I said, "Serta, this is, we're not talking about a six-month house here. You know, this is amazing." She says, "Never mind, I just want to go see it anyway. I'm not talking about buying it." We came here and walked on this property. Before we ever set foot inside the house, we were just struck dumb by, it felt like the spirit was coming out of the earth, going through the heels of our feet, and just coming out through the top. It was just, we were stunned. Neither one of us was speaking. And we looked at each other, and we could tell immediately what we were both thinking about this. That converted us to wanting to make an offer on this house. That was a very difficult proposition because we had two houses in California, one at Sea Ranch and one in Novato, and we couldn't afford to make an offer on a house, a home like this, without selling our two houses. Unfortunately, the guy that put this house together wasn't willing to wait. So we went back and forth on this and made him offers, all of which were contingent upon selling one of our houses, which wasn't acceptable to him. Meanwhile, there's a company called Zango that was starting to bid on this property, the whole 53 acres or so, who had a lot more money than we had. And they wanted to buy this as a retreat for the company because their company takes mangosteen juice, tries to draw as much of the xanthones out of it as a health drink, and bottle it and sell it. And they thought of this would be the perfect retreat for it. So we thought that the odds of us getting this house aren't great. However, it turned out the son-in-law and the daughter of the guy that built this liked this. So we started talking with them, and we made an offer. And, you know, I'm usually a pretty conservative guy, but this is like going off to the end of the plank and leaning over, you know. It was like, what am I doing here? We actually made an offer, figuring we'll find a way to sell at least one of the other houses and get started with this house. Well, at one point, he got upset. I guess the offer from Zango Company was going too slow for him or something. I'm not totally sure. So he said, "Look, the house is yours if you want it." He was going to accept our offer. So we were out looking at furniture. We went up to the Kona side where some of the furniture stores are. And we're looking at furniture, and we got a call on our cell phone. And he said, "I know I said it was yours, but something's come up. The offer has changed from Zango, and so now it's off." Serta was in tears. I mean, by that time, she had her heart set on moving here just because the spiritual feel of this place was so strong and so stunning. And she was in tears. And there's a little island here in Hilo. I was trying to console her all the way back. We stopped looking for furniture. And it wasn't totally, we weren't out of the question. We just looked like a very long shot chance of buying this. We went down to, I think, what the Americans during World War II called Coconut Island down here by Hilo. I don't know if you've been down there, have you? Yes. Coconut Island is actually a very sacred place for Native Hawaiians. Mothers there used to plant their placentas when they had a birth, and it's a very spiritual spot in Native Hawaiian culture. And I said, "Let's go down there, and we'll just let go and just put ourselves sort of at the mercy of the gods, in effect, hug a few trees, and let go." And we did that, and we actually managed to go through our own little ritual and just say, "Whatever is going to be, it's going to be, and we'll accept whatever it is." The next morning, we got a call saying, "It's ours." It was amazing. It was like something is conspiring to move us into this place. It felt like that all the way along. Felt like it was a mistake that we even found it on the web. It was like whatever we did and whatever it looked bad, it looked like something would intervene to put us back on track. And we were just letting go and just trusting that it was going to work out. When we finally ended up buying the place, we had three mortgages we were trying to support. One for each house in California, one for this, and then a fourth one as a bridge loan just to tide us over from then. I could watch money flowing out of our bank accounts faster than I could have imagined it could happen. And I thought, what have we done? You know, we're at high risk here. But then we sold one of the houses, and sort of the pressure was off. But it took a few months of worry before that happened. And again, something just intervened and took care of us.
And what was it you were doing when you were living in Marin County?
Well, I was retired in the house we were in.
Uh-huh. And what had you done professionally?
Before that, when I lived in Larkspur, a different place in Marin County, I was vice president controller for Pacific Bell, now SBC, mm-hmm. and their first vice president of quality after that.
Back to the mangosteen trees, the reason that we're here. During a season when it does finally come into fruit, how many fruit will you get from a single tree? I mean, and I know you can't, not exactly, but...
It's hard to say. I mean, last year we had way more than we could possibly eat ourselves and give away to friends and family, so we weren't in the market for selling them then. Mm-hmm. And the trees, the house was actually vacant for, I'm told, roughly 3 years. So the trees weren't being necessarily cared for as they would have been if someone had been here trying to produce fruit on them. So it's been, and then it took me a while to learn what was needed to take care of the trees. So it's really been just about a year since I started fertilizing it properly and putting the right kind of nutrients into the trees and caring for it properly. So it's no telling. Last year we had two crops because there were two droughts. So we had two crops last year, and it produced quite a bit of fruit. But mangosteens normally don't fruit. Again, it depends on the locale. Southeast Asia and Hawaii are very different locales. But it takes them normally about 9 years, give or take a couple years, before they even start fruiting. And so these trees are only a few years past that, probably. And especially the older ones. I'm not sure how much younger the younger ones are that are interspersed mm-hmm. between those. But the older they get, the more fruit they produce. So there's two things going on here. One is that over time, the trend is upward. They just produce more and more fruit the older they get. And then it's dependent also on the climate change for that particular year. Mm-hmm. If we get two or three dry spells, meaning 3 weeks or more here, then it'll fruit more. If it's wet as it is now, this is the first time it's been this wet for a long time, so I have no idea what the fruiting's going to be like this year. So I have a sample of one, really, last year. Yeah. And there was enough to sell them in the farmer's market, and they draw a pretty good price down there.
Could you describe sort of visually what a mangosteen tree looks like?
Describe? Well, I don't know, maybe 20 feet tall right now at the age they're at. I'm making a wild guess here. I never thought about it before your question. It's a more or less rounded-looking tree, very thick foliage. In fact, we have to prune inside just in order to get in to get the fruit. You don't see most of the fruit from the outside. It grows inside the outer leaves. So you have to find a way to get in there to get at the fruit. We could probably go out there and I could find one we missed from last year and pick it. It'll be rock hard by now, but we can go try that.
Okay. And in your words, could you describe the taste of a mangosteen at its perfect point? I mean, I can do that, but people who listen to Mouthful hear me do that on a regular basis. So I'd like to hear what you think it tastes like.
You could probably do that better than I can. And the reason is it has a taste of its own.
Yeah.
It's not like I could say, well, it tastes a little bit like this. I don't know anything that it tastes a little bit like. It's a white fruit. It's got a red skin around it, which is full of these xanthones. And the Zango drink uses that skin in their drink as well. They grind it up and put it in the drink itself in order to get those health properties. Then there's an in-between pulp. And I in my experimental way, I took a bite of that to see what that was like. That was quite an experience. I don't recommend it because it just about turned my mouth inside out. It was so astringent. It felt like my mouth was sucking itself inside out before I could get it out, get my mouth rinsed. And then there's the fruit inside, which is a white fruit that's in sections that are sort of tightly clumped together. And then inside is the seed, which also has a lot of the xanthan properties. So it's in those kinds of layers. It starts out as this little bright green fruit. It gets a little darker green as it ripens. And then it starts turning red. And at first it's red, which is still not ripe. And then it gets to be this darker maroon color. And somewhere in this maroon range, after the maroon gets relatively dark, but not totally dark, is when it's ripe. You can tell by the color, really. And when it gets to be that color and it's ripe, you can actually take your hands together, make like a little nutcracker out of them, and press on the ends, and the skin will pop open, and you can just sort of twist it, and the fruit will be in front of you.
Punavu'u is a gorgeous black sand beach on the southern rim of Big Island. The endangered hornbill turtle nests here, and there are signs everywhere telling visitors to stay at least 15 feet from the turtles. If you stop by Punavu'u midday, you will likely be put off by the huge tour buses and swarms of people. But if you visit early in the morning and in the evening before the sun sets, you might have the entire place to yourself, as we did on two occasions. It's worth organizing your schedule, as it is one of the most beautiful locations on the entire island. This song, Punavu'u, is actually about a place on Oahu, but there's nothing like approaching Punavu'u Black Sand Beach on the Big Island and having this pop up right then on your iPod. Thanks for tuning in to part two of Mouthful's Big Island Adventure. We'll meet you back here next week for another episode of the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour.